evening from 5 to 7 p.m. Come join us for the best in blues. 90.1
KPFT FM HD2 Houston.
It's Sunday, March 31st, 2024, and this is what's on the People's News. Charges against rogue HPD officer involved with a Harding Street raid dismissed. The Texas Attorney General gets off again. A new program to help people with opioid addiction by Lone Star Legal. The Yonder Report talks about news in the rural community. A new toll road extension adds to environmental issues. March is not just madness for basketball, but also Gambling Awareness Month. All that and more on the People's News. I'm Steve Gallington. This is the People's News, and the People's News starts now. Hi, this is Steve Gallington, producer and host of the People's News. But what is the People's News? The People's News is people-powered news. We are free to report the unvarnished and unspun truth and challenge the status quo of corporate propaganda and social media advertising disguised as real news. The People's News is written, produced, and delivered to your ears without AI. 100% built by flesh and blood people for flesh and blood people. If you have a story that needs to be told, come to us. We accept fully produced audio, written material, or just give us the idea and we will run with it. Shiny new one-hour episodes of The People's News drop each Sunday on the People's News podcast. Hosted by Spreaker.com and linked to my website, Gallington.com. Thanks for listening. A judge threw out two felony murder indictments that have been filed against former Houston Police Department narcotics officer Gerald Goines. He had given false reports in 2019 that resulted in the death of Dennis Tuttle, 59, and his wife, Regina Nichols, 58. Goines had lied to get a search warrant and portrayed the couple as being serious heroin dealers. The raid only found a small amount of marijuana and cocaine in the house. After an investigation of the case, serious corruption was found throughout the HPD Narcotics Division that resulted in many convictions being overturned. In the meantime, the family of Nicholas and Tuttle wait for judgment against the officer and the city. The attorney for the family, Mike Doyle, talked about the case. This is the raid soundbite.
It's really an example that both the U.S. Attorney's Office and the District Attorney's Office, and for that matter, the City of Houston, which the city has spent over $3 million now, or $3 million to keep this all covered up still, while the family have been fighting in the civil case to uncover what we know now really happened. And this is just an example where the district attorney's office has not been putting the effort to get this case to trial over now the sixth year. And it's very disturbing, but it's really what we've seen from day one, it seems like.
It seems like from day one that the city was trying to back off any type of charges, being afraid of any type of backlash from law enforcement.
I think that's true. I mean, I think this is a real good example that the City of Houston Police Department cannot be trusted to investigate itself because it has handicapped itself and it's shown that it's not capable of fully investigating misconduct among police officers in the city. They just don't do that job.
This HPD police officer Goines, we found that he had been involved with numerous cases that drugs, all types of violations of police practice.
I mean, like I said, this is a really good example that even in the most worst kind of case, people are getting killed, and this was not the first time that Goines and this squad wrongfully assaulted innocent citizens, that the City of Houston Police Department, and for that matter, the U.S. Attorney's Office, the District Attorney's Office, just do a terrible job of letting it go for years and years.
This is something also that we had a bunch of other cases that, the city, the Harris County District Attorney kind of missed out on as far as filing charges against police officers for the most part.
Well, I can't really, you know, get the mind of the attorney or the district attorney's office for that matter. I just need to look at what's happened. And what I think the takeaway is between the way the police department handles officer
where does your case go?
That's pretty obvious, which also has a responsibility for enforcing civil rights laws. This is the best thing I know of to be a bad police officer.
What's your case is going to go forward in the civil case?
We've been going forward. We've been taking depositions. I mean, it was delayed a long time by, I believe, the hope that the criminal case would, you know, not take going into 6 years. And our judge, starting last fall, allowed us to get going. The issue is the city has declared all the evidence we've uncovered that we hope to show trial as confidential. So the city at this point is the facts about what really happened even today. And they've been spending millions and millions approaching, we're actually now in excess of $3 billion to do that. Outside lawyers.
That was Mike Doyle, the attorney for Regina Nicholas. Harris County Attorney's Office said they will continue to fight against Goins. The civil lawsuit against the city of Houston continues and will cost Houston taxpayers millions. Hi, this is Steve Gallington, producer and host of The People's News. But what is The People's News? The People's News is people-powered news. We are free to report the unvarnished and unspun truth and challenge the status quo of corporate propaganda and social media advertising disguised as real news. The People's News is written, produced, and delivered to your ears without AI. 100% built by flesh and blood people for flesh and blood people. If you have a story that needs to be told, come to us. We accept fully produced audio, written material, or just give us the idea and we will run with it. Shiny new one-hour episodes of The People's News drop each Sunday on The People's News Podcast. Hosted by Spreaker.com and linked to my website, Gallington.com. Thanks for listening. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton beat another court case against him in the felony security fraud charges. The trial against him is also canceled, and he only has to do 100 hours of community service, take 15 hours of legal ethics courses, and pay around $270,000 in restitution to his accusers. We talked to Matt Engel with the Lone Star Project, who has been following Paxton for some time.
Well, it's extraordinary, and it tells you that, there are special rules for high-ranking elected officials, particularly Republican officials in Texas. Ken Paxton is a perfect example of a individual who has abused his office the entire time he's been in public office. This case was pending for 9 years, and the reason it was pending was that Paxton himself engaged in a series of delays and over again got special treatment by the courts that allowed him to push this case forward nearly a decade. And by the time it got to the end, that the prosecutors had run out of resources and run out of the ability to fully prosecute it. And so what they did ultimately was reach a settlement. Now, make no mistake, Paxton is essentially admitting guilt. He's having to pay over $200,000 in restitution, and he's going to have to do community service. You don't do that if you didn't do anything wrong. But it is a slap on the wrist compared to the jail time that you should have served or the hard, cold finding of guilt, which is what he deserved. And so it shows that he gets special treatment, and that's what's happened with Republican elected officials in a MAGA world, and particularly in Texas. That being indicted is almost a badge of honor in that world.
Where does he go from here? Because he still has a couple other cases that's going against him.
Really important point, Richard. Really important point, because he is still under FBI investigation for selling access to his office. What he did was he provided special access and took special action to help a contributor, donor, who was also providing a job to Paxton's mistress. And while that was all going on, a number of his top aides blew the whistle on him, let the feds know about it, and then he fired them. And so on another action he has pending against them is litigation for the wrongful firing of his most loyal staff. And so the problems aren't over for Ken Paxton, but it is extraordinary that within the Republican Party, he could not be stronger. Again, it's like being corrupt and taking criminal actions is what provides you juice in MAGA world. I mean, and it kind of makes sense when you realize that that's exactly the way they treat Trump as well. But I don't think, though, that that same influence and that same political strength will be maintained in a general election, assuming that Paxton has to face a credible Democratic opponent in 2026. And I think Democrats do see Paxton as weakened, and I think it will encourage strong candidates, and it will encourage donors who actually want to get a grip on our state to help a strong opponent for Paxton in 2026.
Paxton is really strong as far as politically, and he knows how to work the system. and this is a good example. Of this. Why in terms that the judge offered him this sweet deal?
Well, what happened was the prosecutors were at their wits' end, and they reached the end of their rope in terms of their resources. A trial had been scheduled. They were going to have to put together the arguments, and they had over the period of time, the pay for the prosecutors had been cut. The time had gone on so long that one of the main prosecutors had left and had to go pursue other things in their practice, and so it ended up being running the real risk that if you'd gone to trial with the prosecution being woefully underfunded and underprepared, then Paxton could have gotten off altogether. Now, Paxton himself, you'd think if he was really convinced of his own innocence that he would have pressed the advantage and not agreed to anything and forced a trial. But he knows he's guilty. He knows he committed every one of these acts. And that's why he cut basically a sweetheart deal I'll do some community service, pay over $250,000, and then act like nothing ever happened. But I don't blame the prosecutors. Again, they had been strung out over almost a decade.
What do we? Do you think he's going to pay any of the fines and or do any community service, or that's just?
Oh, I think he probably will, but I think it'll be done very quietly. I mean, the notion of Paxton doing community service is laughable. I mean, if there was any justice served, they'd make him work for Catholic Charities helping immigrants who are resettling, but I'm sure that won't happen. It'll be something that's probably not real public service, but I do think he's going to have to cough up $250,000 or so.
But what about his he's still facing a disciplinary committee in the state, for the state bar?
Yeah, and I doubt the institutional strength of the state bar is tough enough to really press that. I hope they do. We saw that one of the Trump insurrectionists is going to be disbarred in California, but the Texas bar has usually been pretty timid, to tell you the truth. And so I'm not holding out much hope there. But I do think, though, that the whistleblower suit is going to be pursued, and I think that he'll be found liable there. And I also think that sooner or later, the Justice Department will really come calling and indict him because the sale of access to his office is tied directly to the whistleblowers, and it is just a stark example of profound corruption. And he did it for a tawdry reason. He did it because he was covering up and trying to take care of his mistress. Again, the parallels with Trump are really extraordinary, and it throws into relief that it's not so much that the system is rigged for Republicans. It's that the Republican structure in Texas has become totally corrupted.
Was this one of the judges that were appointed by the governor, or?
I don't think the judge did anything wrong. I think we can point to the judge here. Again, I think this was a matter of the prosecutors not having the resources to go to trial, and Paxton, rather than, which is extraordinary, rather than saying, okay, I'm going to press my advantage, force him to go to trial, and I'll win, he was afraid he wouldn't. He was afraid because he knows criminals who are guilty live their life in fear. And so he was willing to cut the deal. I don't think the judge had much choice but to accept it.
Well, where does Paxton go from here? Because he's still attacking. He's still attacking people that were against the governor, where people that tried to get him disbarred. He's still attacking them.
Oh, sure, but remember that fight, that big war, that all this influence of Paxton, that all just exists within the Republican primary world. That's just fighting on their side of the street. And again, that side of the street has been totally corrupted. The Republican Party now has three factions. They have the criminal faction, which Paxton and Trump participate in. They have the corrupt faction, the pay-to-play faction that Greg Abbott participates in. And then they have the compliant and faction of the Republican Party. And those are Republicans who know better who go along, the John Cornyn types. But they don't have, there aren't really any conservatives in the Republican Party anymore. There aren't any real traditional small government Republicans. All the things that, you know, you can actually have a political debate about. It's just corrupt. But that doesn't get Paxton off the hook. If as Democrats, we can get it together and provide a real choice, because I think Texans who are fair-minded, who are Democrats, who are independents, and even some Republicans who are totally disillusioned, they would look to an alternative for Paxton. It's just incumbent upon us Democrats to get it together and decide on one person, and once we have that one person, is to everybody get behind him or her.
Before I let you leave, I just got a email from Ted Cruz attacking his opponent, his Democratic opponent. Is there any chance of him losing his seat in Texas?
Oh, yeah, I think that there's a real chance. Again, obviously, any Democrat running statewide is less than 50-50 that they win, but that doesn't mean, candidates who get into the race less than 50-50 win all the time. And Colin Allred is absolutely the strongest possible candidate we could have put against against Cruz in this election cycle. He ran a good primary. Roland Gutierrez ran an honorable primary as well, but lost, and I appreciate the fact that he conceded graciously. And I think Cruz is in real trouble, and he knows it. I mean, Cruz is really a very, very hard person for even the most partisan Republican to get excited about. Nobody likes him. Not any of his Senate colleagues, Democrats or Republicans, like him. He's somebody with a low character, a high self-esteem, and really is so conciliatory to Trump that it's embarrassing as a Texan. And so I think Colin Allred has a real shot.
That was Matt Engel with the Lone Star Project. You can subscribe to his email letters by going to LoneStarProject.net. Lone Star Project is all put together .net. Hi, this is Steve Gallington, producer and host of The People's News. But what is The People's News? The People's News is people-powered news. We are free to report the unvarnished and unspun truth and challenge the status quo of corporate propaganda and social media advertising disguised as real news. The People's News is written, produced, and delivered to your ears without AI. 100% built by flesh and blood people, for flesh and blood people. If you have a story that needs to be told, come to us. We accept fully produced audio, written material, or just give us the idea and we will run with it. Shiny new one-hour episodes of The People's News drop each Sunday on The People's News Podcast. Hosted by Spreaker.com and linked to my website, Gallington.com. Thanks for listening. Rise to Recovery provides free civil legal aid to those in active recovery from opioids. The following comes from an interview provided by Lone Star Legal Aid.
Hello, everyone. My name is Natalie Cochran, and I'm the Communications Assistant for Lone Star Legal Aid. I am joined today by Lone Star Legal Aid's Supervising Attorney of Program-Wide Units, Lindsay Eustace, who is going to answer questions about our Rise to Recovery program, which is an initiative to assist those affected by the opioid crisis. Lindsay, please introduce yourself, and then we will get started.
All right, sure. Well, my name is Lindsay Eustace, and like you mentioned, I'm a supervising attorney with Lone Star Legal Aid. I've been with Lone Star Legal Aid for 11 years now, and I currently work with the Opioid Use Disorder Unit that we have now called the Rise to Recovery Unit.
Can you provide a brief overview of the Rise to Recovery program and its primary objectives?
Sure. The basic idea of the Rise to Recovery program is providing legal assistance to individuals and families who have been affected by opioid use. The opioid epidemic has touched far too many people and has caused devastating consequences across our communities.
What inspired the creation of this program, and what specific needs or challenges does it aim to address within the community?
Lone Star Legal Aid, along with other legal providers in the state of Texas, were tasked with helping this population of people. The legal needs of families that have been impacted by opioids vary and are unique to each family, but we handle anything from child custody and divorce to expunging a criminal record.
How does the program and its legal professionals support individuals on their path to recovery?
Okay, so we like to take a holistic approach. We have all underwent extensive training regarding opioid use, best practices in working with people with a substance use disorder, and then most importantly, providing legal advice that best suits the situation they may have found themselves in.
Can you share a success story or notable achievement that has resulted from the implementation of the program?
Yes. Just this week, I represented a client in a hearing where the agency was delayed in responding to his food stamp application. What's important to note is when individuals or families are in recovery, having a stable household is important. Things like being able to pay for food, rent, and medication are all very important to maintaining a stable household. Also, our medical legal partnership with the UT Heroes program is something we are really excited about. We're able to work closely with their staff and address the needs of their clients in a cohesive environment.
Are there specific eligibility criteria or requirements for individuals seeking assistance through the program?
Yes, our funding allows us to help people living at or below 200% of the federal poverty level. So someone who earns less than twice the amount considered poverty by the government, which allows us to help a lot of people. For example, a household of one that makes $29,000 per year or $60,000 per year for a household of four would be eligible for our services.
How has the program evolved since its inception? And are there any upcoming developments or expansions planned for the future?
Yeah, I wish I could say that the program is coming to an end in the near future and that opioid use is no longer prevalent in our communities. But the truth is, Texas is just starting to get our hands around this problem. As soon as we started Rise to Recovery, we hit the ground running and have not stopped. Our legal hotline stays pretty busy. We plan on being around as long as the need is there.
How does the program engage with local partners or organizations to maximize its impact and reach a broader audience?
Lone Star Legal Aid has standing partnerships that we have worked with for decades. And honestly, we wouldn't be where we are without those partnerships. We've worked with community organizations, just a lot of people over the years. But now we're able to open up our services to more people that we could in the past and help people and families that have been impacted by opioids. So we've gained a new set of partnerships. Things like treatment facilities, recovery centers, safe injection sites, churches, and schools. Schools are doing so much right now with opioid use disorder awareness. So we go anywhere we can to discuss how we can help and what services we offer.
Lastly, what are some key messages or takeaways you would like the public to know about the Rise to Recovery program?
Definitely like for people to know that we provide comprehensive legal services in an accepting and affirming environment. We also want to provide individualized support to people living with opioid use disorder during their own rise to recovery and promote public understanding of the challenges that everyday folks face as a result of this national opioid epidemic. Lastly, we hope our efforts not only increase stability for individuals and their families, but also lead to widespread acceptance, understanding, and ultimately an increase in availability of supported services for these clients and their families.
Thank you, Lindsay, for being a part of this program and your contribution to its success. We encourage those in legal assistance to contact Lone Star Legal Aid to learn more about how the Rise to Recovery program can make a difference in their lives. To access our services or for more information about Rise to Recovery, please visit www.lonestarlegal.org or call our dedicated hotline at 1-888-251-3492.
If you want to learn more, you can go to lonestarlegalaid.org. Hi, this is Steve Gallington, producer and host of The People's News. But what is The People's News? The People's News is people-powered news. We are free to report the unvarnished and unspun truth and challenge the status quo of corporate propaganda and social media advertising disguised as real news. The People's News is written, produced, and delivered to your ears without AI. 100% built by flesh and blood people for flesh and blood people. If you have a story that needs to be told, come to us. We accept fully produced audio, written material, or just give us the idea and we will run with it. Shiny new one-hour episodes of The People's News drop each Sunday on The People's News Podcast. Hosted by Spreaker.com and linked to my website, Gallington.com. Thanks for listening. The rural community is often ignored, but we on The People's News bring you the Yonder Report from Public News Service and Roz Brown.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. West Texans recovering from historic wildfires will need help with housing and health, according to a new study. Urban Institute senior researcher Ann Janod expects the low density of rural housing stock, especially for renters, to be a challenge.
Places are just more spread out, and that can really lead to challenges for administering aid and recovery resources over long distances.
More than 1 million acres of the Texas Panhandle burned, and Janod says few rural towns have the necessary resources for such a disaster.
Civic leaders, elected and appointed officials, they're wearing 10 different hats.
She says translation services will be key where English is a second language. Rural health service gaps, where folks tend to be older, could also be significant. Life doesn't always get easier when incarcerated people leave prison. But Olivia Weeks says an Eastern Kentucky program is working to ease that transition.
In 7 rural Kentucky counties, First Day Forward provides people who leave jail or prison resources to be ready for life on the outside. Everything from getting a driver's license to finding affordable housing. Brittany Harrington, a program project manager, was once one of those folks.
But every time I left incarceration, I was faced with same people, same places, same habits, same routines, no new skill, and it got worse really, really quick. We don't want that for our people.
The program aims for returning citizens to make and follow a plan. That can include peer support and help staying sober and in recovery. As a result, their recidivism rates are about 30% lower than they might be otherwise. I'm Olivia Weeks.
The free black people and former slaves who founded Nicodemus, Kansas, had high hopes in the late 1880s. Many never materialized, but that doesn't diminish its importance for their descendants. Angela Bates and the town's historical society have filmed a new documentary reenacting the original journey.
It is my personal family story, and it is the nation's story.
After the Civil War, many black Southerners headed west, seeking a new life.
Nicodemus thrived initially until the town was bypassed by the railroad, undermining its economy. Today, fewer than 25 people live there. But Johnella Holmes with the Kansas Black Farmers Association says hundreds come for the homecoming emancipation celebration held every summer since 1878.
Those African American pioneers and homesteaders, they carved a new way of life. That resilience is a sense of pride, not just for African Americans, but for all of us that are in the rural communities.
In 1996, Kansas made Nicodemus a National Historic Site. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
That was the Yonder Report, brought to you by Roz Brown of Public News Service. Hi, this is Steve Gallington, producer and host of The People's News. But what is The People's News? The People's News is people-powered news. We are free to report the unvarnished and unspun truth and challenge the status quo of corporate propaganda and social media advertising disguised as real news. The People's News is written, produced, and delivered to your ears without AI. 100% built by flesh and blood people, for flesh and blood people. If you have a story that needs to be told, come to us. We accept fully produced audio, written material, or just give us the idea and we will run with it. Shiny new one-hour episodes of The People's News drop each Sunday on The People's News Podcast, hosted by Spreaker.com and linked to my website, Gallington.com. Thanks for listening. Harris County Commissioner's Court voted unanimously to greenlight the Hardy Downtown Connector, a roughly 3-mile stretch of new highway construction connecting the Harris County Toll Road to downtown Houston, cutting through the near Northside community. This community has suffered from gentrification, neglect, and railroads that have brought in a high amount of cancer. The expansion has been held back since 2000, but despite the environmental concerns, Harris County Commissioner's Court decided to go along with the project. Jennifer Hadaia, Executive Director of Airlines Houston, spoke on what this project does along with its environmental impacts.
Neighborhoods like near Northside have been inundated for decades with multiple sources of air pollution. And the footprint where the new Hardy Downtown Connector will be is interesting because in that exact footprint, it's about a 3.5-ish mile stretch from the North Loop to the downtown viaduct, and in that footprint are already multiple other sources. There are concrete batch plants in that footprint, there are concrete crushers in the footprint, there are metal recyclers in the footprint, and of course, as you mentioned, there is a multi-track Union Pacific train line in that footprint that on a regular basis, multiple times a day, has multiple trains crisscrossing the neighborhood carrying chemicals, which of course put the community at risk of any kind of leak or derailment. So this is a corridor that already has sources of air pollution in it, and it's a corridor where people live near it. There are homes right next to this corridor, and we now know that there will be an additional highway being built in the same corridor. It is a, as you said, a connector from the north end of the Hardy Toll Road into downtown Houston and parts beyond. And it will add a 4-lane, partially elevated and partially trenched highway to that mix of pollution sources. We know that more car lanes lead to induced traffic and induced congestion. There will be more cars and trucks coming through the neighborhood, and that will increase the impact of the other pollution sources cumulatively to those of us who live in the neighborhood.
It also adds to the people being misplaced, people being being placed somewhere else because of the construction going on. So even more people are going to be moved out. And,
yeah, that's a good observation. What Hector has assured us is that there is no additional residential right-of-way needed to build the project. But I think you're pointing out something different, which is who wants to live right next to the construction of a 4-lane highway? And the construction process itself affects quality of life. I mean, there's pollution and dust and trucks coming in and out building a highway, and the highway's not even functional yet at that point. So that's a really good point. I think highways, we know from other communities and from studies conducted here in Houston, have an impact on quality of life in a number of ways. And you're right. It's not the quality of life I think any of us imagine to walk outside our front doors and stare at a highway, not to mention the dust, not to mention the pollution, not to mention the fact that it does add another layer of separation to the Near North Side community between our two major zip codes, 009 and 026, which had already been separated by the train line, which had already been separated by Highway 59. So you're exactly right. That's a really good observation. You know, construction in and of itself has an impact on quality of life.
It seems like they're not really picking on that community, but they're actually making it easy because of the low-income area that they can do these type of things. Has Commissioner Report said anything about the general problem?
So commissioners have acknowledged that the way projects like this in the past have been done, namely in our recent history, the proposal for North Houston Highway Improvement Project or the I-45 expansion, did not take into consideration the wants, needs, and concerns of community members. They did praise HECTRA, the Harris County Toll Road Authority, for the amount of community engagement that they conducted throughout the process of returning this project to the forefront. And to be fair, yes, HECTRA came out. They met with a lot of residents. They held community meetings. And they've made some promises to the community. They have committed to putting roadside parks and trails, bike lanes, dog parks, community center, softball fields. They've committed to building those things right by the highway as a way to make up for the fact that they are also building a highway in the community. I maintain that our neighborhood, because of its history of being under-resourced, same reason why we have so many pollution sources, is what's led to the community being under-resourced. We absolutely deserve these quality of life amenities. We deserve parks and trails and softball fields and community centers, but I don't believe they should come at the price of public health. I don't think they should come, there should be a requirement that we also get a four-lane highway. I wish that there was an investment being made in the community that would bring those quality of life amenities to us without the detrimental impacts of a four-lane highway. That would be my wish.
Time and time again, the neighborhood has promised a lot of things. They've had community meetings, they met with the public, and at the end of the day, they do the same thing they've been doing for years in the neighborhood. Is this something, if you looked at the plan they actually mm-hmm. put forward, is there any signs of any type of community involvement within that program?
Well, I would say on Tuesday, when commissioners officially greenlit HECTRA to go forward with this project, to go into the next stage, they made some motions on Tuesday, and I hope the motions get as much attention, attention because they're meaningful. And two of the motions, I believe, will have a positive impact on the pollution that this project will bring. And more importantly, they come with accountability. Those motions say to HECTRA, we want you to do these things, and we want you to start reporting to us every 30 days on the progress. And that's, I think, significant. I think that's Commissioner saying to HECTRA, this is a big project. We are greenlighting this project, and we want you to hold yourself accountable to the community and to these commitments and come back to us and report on your progress every 30 days. I think that's meaningful. And those two motions are both ways that I am very hopeful will reduce the pollution impact. One of them is for HECTRA to consider adding bus rapid transit to the Hardy downtown connector. So adding a transit line and mass rapid transit takes a lane away. You have to have a dedicated lane for that. And so that would be one fewer car lane that would bring that many fewer cars into the neighborhood. And then we know that, you know, mass public transit, one of the best solutions we have to get people out of vehicles at scale. And so that will help the region across the board for all of those people who do not take their single occupancy car that day. So that is something that HECTRA has been instructed to do and report back on in 30 days. The second one is also pretty meaningful. It shows a glaring gap in HECTRA's process, but the commissioners stepped in to fill it. So there has not been an environmental impact study conducted on this project as of yet. They have not studied it. They have not done their due diligence to truly understand what a four-lane highway near Northside would do to the environment, not just the air, but also the soil and the water. And so commissioners also instructed HECTRA to form an environmental mitigation work group and an environmental mitigation strategy that will uncover the environmental impacts and then hold Hetro accountable to solving them. And that work group includes incredible experts. I won't lie. These are great folks. Harris County Pollution Control, Harris County Attorney's Office, Harris County Public Health, experts in the public health impacts of air pollution. So that was another motion commissioners made. I think both of those motions are meaningful. I think they show the commissioners' concern that this project is going forward, and I think it shows the commissioners' desire for Hector to be accountable to the impacts of these this project on air quality and quality of life. So those motions are pretty significant, and I'm very pleased with them, and I'm thankful to the commissioners for making those motions.
All right, and that last question is, this is about you know, air, we're talking about air quality, and we see the amount of people that are buying EVs right now, but the amount of EV charging stations is not sufficient to the amount of people that are buying EV cars. Are you seeing the same thing as far as like more people adding EV charging stations around town?
It's not an area that I've looked at very closely, and I'll tell you why. I think the transition to electrified vehicles of all kinds, so not just single occupancy, but trucks, right, the big ones, the things that emit diesel fumes, is going to be a very long prospect. And we can't wait for everything to become electrified to start addressing pollution sources in the community. It's just not going to happen fast enough or at scale. And one of the reasons it isn't going to happen fast enough or at scale is what you've identified, is that the infrastructure has not been created to support people to have personal electric vehicles. And there might be a little better infrastructure, I think, to support commercial electric vehicles. But again, it's going to be a very slow transition. I think it's also important to note that electrified vehicles don't have tailpipe emissions, but they do create pollution. And they create particulate pollution that comes off of tires. And so it's not they don't become 100% net zero in terms of their impact to the environment, particulate matter being one of the most concerning sources of air pollution. I think bigger picture, longer term, to get to true attainment of our national air quality standards is going to require us to rethink the value of the single occupancy vehicle. It's going to require us to rethink the value of mass public transit. It's going to make us rethink the value of a high density transit oriented development so that we can work where we live and recreate where we live and not be dependent on massive transportation systems like what we're investing today. So I think it's part of a bigger solution, but I would hesitate to say that EVs are going to solve the air pollution problem from cars.
That was Jennifer Hadaia, Executive Director of Air Alliance Houston. Hi, this is Steve Gallington, producer and host of The People's News. But what is the People's News? The People's News is people-powered news. We are free to report the unvarnished and unspun truth and challenge the status quo of corporate propaganda and social media advertising disguised as real news. The People's News is written, produced, and delivered to your ears without AI. 100% built by flesh and blood people for flesh and blood people. If you have a story that needs to be told, come to us. We accept fully produced audio, written material, or just give us the idea and we will run with it. Shiny new one-hour episodes of The People's News drop each Sunday on The People's News Podcast, hosted by Spreaker.com and linked to my website, Gallington.com. Thanks for listening. The NCAA Men's and Women's College Basketball Championship Tournament, also known as March Madness, brings in billions of dollars nationwide. Betting on March Madness has become as easy as just two clicks on a cell phone. But just like drugs and alcohol, addiction to gambling has become a multi-billion dollar problem in the U.S. March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and we talked to Ken White, Executive Director with the National Council on Problem Gambling, about the issue and how it affects families.
So a couple things. One is that March is Problem Gambling Awareness Month, and it's an initiative to raise public awareness of gambling problems created by us, by the National Council on Problem Gambling. And we put it, you know, we created it and placed it in March deliberately to also capitalize on all the betting that goes around the NCAA tournament, March Madness, right? So we wanted to link those two things in people's minds, you know, create awareness of gambling problems when so much of the nation is focused on the Final Four, the Sweet 16, buzzer beaters, things like that. because gambling is increasingly intertwined with sports. And so there's a lot of risk, as you say, for kids getting exposed to gambling ads, the kids seeing their peers maybe and other adults gambling. And so there's never been more availability of gambling in the United States. And through your cell phones, there's never been more accessibility to gambling in the United States. And so we think that's raising the risk for gambling problems. And so it's really important to talk about that year-round, but especially in March, not just during the tournament, but also because it's Problem Gambling Awareness Month.
You know, gambling right now is so easy now. It's just a matter of just two clicks away. You can make bets. You can make bets on your phone. You can make bets. You can make bets on your computer at work. And just telling people not to gamble now should be is even easier than it was even 5 years ago. And now you have commercials and stuff that promote it.
Yes, before 2018, you didn't see advertising for sports books, during the game, even now, in arena, in stadium. And so there's a lot more exposure to gambling opportunities. And, of course, participation has dramatically increased for sports betting. And so it's really important to make sure that those messages include, a warning sign, just like we do with alcohol and other types of advertising where, it's a legal product, you can promote it. But if you promote it, know that there's a certain percentage of people who are going to be harmed and that there's a lot of people who are seeing those ads that really need that warning message to make sure they don't develop a problem or to try and prevent them from going too far when they bet.
I heard people like the Dallas Mavericks owner say that gambling should be even more available. When making it more available, it eases the amount of people that become problem gamblers.
I would disagree. I think there are some interesting policy discussions in that if you bring, for example, sports betting, if you make it legal and regulated, there should be more protections in place. To shift people away from the illegal market is probably a benefit. But I think on the flip side, when you legalize it and you regulate it and you promote it, there's a lot more people who are going to be gambling. And so and the types of gambling that are being promoted and endorsed by states have a lot of risk. So how that all balances out, I don't know. Obviously, the people that own teams and leagues want to look at the benefits. But there's also costs, and I think you can't have a complete picture unless you're looking at both sides of that equation. And we would say that there are just as many increased costs as there is increased tax revenue.
Yeah, and that's the problem right now is cities and states are now looking at the tax revenue that's coming out of the commercial gambling industry.
It's seen as a tax on the willing. But it's also a tax on the unwell. And like any other product, you've got to look at the cost and benefits. And so and one way to help better balance those costs and benefits is to make sure that some of that revenue that's coming in is devoted to preventing and treating the very problem. And unfortunately, there in Texas, for example, the state has done an absolutely catastrophically bad job of doing that. So in Texas, there's no public funding from the lottery revenue. So the lottery sells about $4 billion of tickets a year. The state makes about $2 billion in profit, yet they don't take a single penny of that money and put it back to preventing or treating gambling problems. And so in Texas, it's a great example. Were Texas to legalize betting on sports, we would look at their existing track record with other forms of legalized gambling, and we would be very, very skeptical about the ability of the state to say, oh, okay, of course we're going to do sports betting right, because they do the lottery pretty poorly in terms of responsible gambling, in terms of protecting their own citizens from harm, and in terms of making sure that if Texans do develop problems playing the lottery, they've got somewhere to go to get help.
How are you dealing with this in Europe, and especially in England, where you have athletes that have become problem gamblers and tried and have gone from making millions of dollars to being broke? And have nothing. We've had athletes here in the States that have the same problem. So how are they dealing with that, especially in England and in Canada?
So I think many of the things that make you an elite athlete, many of the traits that make you an elite athlete also make you a risky gambler. So obviously being highly competitive, being willing to, if you will, play through pain, believing in your own skill, those are all great things when you're playing on the court, but they can work against you when you're playing on that green felt table. So we believe athletes and those around them, coaches, referees, anybody involved in sports needs to have a higher level of education to make sure they know not just the law, but the warning signs of addiction. They need to know what it is about themselves that makes them riskier gamblers. And, they need really specific guidance and education training. So to make sure that they don't develop a problem, and certainly that their gambling problem doesn't lead them to either harm themselves or to fix a game and harm their entire team and maybe their entire sport.
You mentioned the lottery. Texas, people don't really look at that as being gambling. No, they look at that as just like, I buy a ticket and it's fun. I have a chance of winning millions. But you and I know that that can be addictive after a while because they don't just buy one ticket. Like I saw a lady yesterday buying 12 tickets.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of people, not just in Texas, but across the United States and around the world, that don't see the lotteries gambling or don't see church bingo as gambling. And there's some people that don't see sports betting as gambling because they think they've got a lot of experience. Maybe they used to play that sport in college. And so they think, I'm really investing. Because I was a former basketball player. I know everything about basketball, so for those people, they approach that activity with higher risk, because if they don't see it as gambling, they're probably not taking the steps necessary to protect themselves from addiction. And the good news is, I think it's important to note here that gambling addiction probably is only affects 2% of the adult population in the United States. That's still 9 million people. I want to be clear, it's a big number. But that does mean that the majority of people who participate in gambling will not and do not develop a problem. And you can break it down, though. So, maybe it's 5% of active gamblers might have a problem because not everybody bets. There's a good 15, 20% of Americans that haven't bet in the past year. So if you look at people who actively gambled in the past year, you're looking maybe at 5%. Of people who may have a problem. And then you start to break it down. If you're looking at people who gambled online in the past week, probably 10% of them, maybe a little bit more, might show signs of a gambling problem in a given year. So things like frequency of gambling, obviously the more frequently you gamble, the more likely to have a problem. And then there's some other risk factors there. But a lot of this growth in gambling problems that we've seen across the United States is among young male online sports bettors.
And that's what I've been seeing is like young males and even high schoolers picking up gambling because they can do it over their phone.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, and they shouldn't be able to do it. The legal regulated sites, and obviously in Texas it's completely illegal, but they're playing things that would argue that they're not gambling. Daily fantasy sports, for example. There's some social casino games, some social sports betting games on the internet where you can download those apps and, they may have some free plays, but eventually at some point you're going to be spending your time and money on it. So there's a lot of kind of gray areas out there where technology makes it easier than ever for kids, for example, to access gray market gambling, to get all the psychological thrill. Maybe they can win some money, and it's an easy way for them to develop some bad habits that can lead them into problems now, or that can lead them into problems once they turn 21 and are able to access the legal regulated sites.
Yeah, I mean, I'm looking. Question I also have is, when you actually become an addict and trying to get help, I'm looking in Houston in general, and you have Texas Gamblers Anonymous, but after that, you don't really have that many places to go for help,
No. So it's a really important point. So one, I want to make sure everybody knows that's listening, there's always hope and help available. When you call 800-GAMBLER, call, text, or chat to 800-GAMBLER, we're going to get you resources. And some of those resources might be online, or they might be literature we can mail you. There's help out there. But the other part of that equation is, like you said, on the ground, services there. Texas has never invested any of its gambling profits and trying to help make sure that there's somewhere for folks to go if they really do get jammed up. Gamblers Anonymous is a self-supporting thing, but and it's great. But you know, you need more resources. So there's a real challenge in Texas right now, and a lot of other places where, you know, if you call the helpline, we'll get you all the help that's available. But and there's just not a lot there in Texas at the moment.
And that's because this state just wants you to continue to feed into their funds and give them funds.
Well, ultimately it's a decision of the legislature, you know, and the legislature gets elected by people. So, you know, folks are concerned about this, you know, talk to their representatives, you know, you start to bring an issue, start to raise an issue. And again, that's, we know sports betting is going to be a big legislative item next year when the legislature reconvenes. And it makes us pretty skeptical that any deal to legalize sports betting in Texas, even if it has, you know, some gaudy amount of funds for problem gambling now, it's going to take a couple years to set up a system because there's nothing in place now in the state. You know, you can't just create a whole problem gambling prevention, education, treatment system overnight. And it's a big challenge, you know, for the state to say, trust us, we're going to do sports betting right. Doing sports betting right means being able to build on the foundation of an addiction prevention infrastructure. The gambling addiction prevention infrastructure just does not exist right now in the state. So that's, you know, that's a big policy issue. It's kind of a hidden addiction, but it's there. We think the amount of people who are betting in the United States is growing. You know, the amount of people who are betting sports is growing. And but it's a really important time to be able to have that conversation about, you know, what happens if you get a little bit too into it, and how can you help a friend, you know, who might have a problem, and making sure that you know, that folks know to call, text or chat to 800-GAMBLER, but then making sure that there's more resources on the other end of that line, so that if they do get jammed up, you know, that they're going to be able to reduce their problems before it becomes all too severe, and even in some cases life-threatening. So it's really great for all your listeners to be able to know that, you know, that there's steps you can take. This doesn't have to be a one-way street.
That was Keith White, the executive director with the National Council on Problem Gambling. Contact the National Problem Gambling Helpline, which offers hope and help without stigma or shame. Call or text 1-800-GAMBLER or visit 1-800-GAMBLER-CHAT, all put together. That's 1-800-GAMBLER-CHAT, put together, .org. Help is available 24/7, and it is free and confidential. The People's News is a production of Steve Gallington and Richard Hanna and is protected by copyright laws. All the information broadcast on air and online, as well as published in both print and or online, including articles, audio clips, illustrations, graphics, photographs, and videos, are protected by these copyright and other state and federal intellectual property laws. Therefore, you may not use our content in any prohibited way, including reproducing, publishing, transmitting, selling, rewriting, broadcasting, or posting on the internet without the expressed written permission of the People's News. Prohibited use also includes publication of our material in printed or electronic brochures, newsletters or flyers, as well as all website or email distribution. To obtain permission to use copyrighted material, email Steve Gallington at steve@gallington.com. Thank you.
KPFT Artist Profile, Glenna Bell.
Hey everybody, this is Glenna Bell. I'm here at the KPFT Studios. Beautiful brand new building here on Caroline. So excited to be here. So I've been asked to talk just for a second about what I love about KPFT. Not only that they play my music, but I'm a listener. I listen to KPFT every day. And there are just so many great shows from the past that I've always enjoyed, and a bunch of new shows that are coming out for the future. So I hope everybody will tune in and continue to tune in and support our local community radio, because it's true, there really is nothing else like it. This is only in Houston. KPFT 90.1 FM rocks!
KPFT Artist Profile, Jeff Plankenhorn.
Well, I think there's two things that I really, really love about KPFT and about this style of radio in general. One is how good it is to the artist, and two is how good it is to your ears. Because the thing is, these are actual people picking actual music that they dig, that they curate for you to check out. If you turn on KPFT, you might hear one thing in 1 hour and one thing in another. And to be able to come on and say, hey, I'm playing a show, and get to an audience this large, it's just a real gift. And I will go so far as to say this. If you really, really want to help, KPFT 90.1, call 713-526-5738 or go to kpft.org. Become somebody who gives, who donates, and it'll make you feel good.
Listen for his